I'm Scott Schiff with the Atlas Society, introducing our senior scholar, Dr. Richard Salzman here, sharing his 7 most common smears against self-interest. I'm going to put a link to a previous piece he has on the subject. And while Richard is giving his thoughts, feel free to raise your hands with questions. We'll bring you up to the stage to ask when he's done with his opening. And again, I encourage you to share the room. Richard, thanks for doing this topic. What are the 7 most common smears against self-interest?
Well, thank you, Scott. I want to start with a brief motivation, which is self-interest and egoism as an ethic is so central to the objectivist philosophy that I think it's very important to be able to identify ways that it's either dismissed or caricatured or misrepresented. And I think you'll see after I give this kind of classification that you'll see it, if you haven't already, almost everywhere. But these have to be understood, identified, rejected. I think this 7 I'll give you are really helpful in terms of disentangling the rational view from the non-rational view. And let me just also say that it's often forgotten that the subtitle to Ayn Rand's Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, it does have a subtitle, and it's called A New Concept of Egoism. Now, this reminds us that, and she actually says it in the essay, it's not as if she was the first one to advocate egoism, but she had a specific take on it by saying it has to be rational egoism. And many of the caricatures and smears I'll give you tonight basically come from a reluctance or an unwillingness of people to bring rationality into the story. Now, I'm just going to list them right here, right off the top for those taking notes, and then I'll elaborate on each. Here are the 7. That self-interest is automatic, myopic, atomistic, materialistic, hedonistic, antagonistic, and finally sadistic, as in sadism. Now, maybe the first thing you'll notice is that there's a kind of rhyming here. And I did that purposely as I thought about the classification scheme I wanted to provide. I wanted it to be memorable, and I also ordered these in a way that you'll find that as you go through the list, some of the later caricatures count on a compendium of other caricatures, generally. So the first ones I give you will be kind of a brazen, just straight off the top, wrong. But then as we go through the list, the subsequent ones will be a little more complicated, a composition of other errors. You'll see. So again, to repeat, the first one, automatic, the second one, myopic, the third, atomistic, the fourth, materialistic, 5, hedonistic, 6, antagonistic, 7, sadistic. So let's go through these as briefly as I can. I'm only going to go for about 20 minutes here. The first one, self-interest as automatic. Now, this is the idea that everyone is automatically selfish, that it's inbred, that we're hardwired to be that way, that we have a, quote, instinct for self-preservation. Something along those lines. So there's various ways to put it, but there's in The Virtue of Selfishness, actually, there's an essay by Nathaniel Brandon, Isn't Everyone Selfish? Dealing with this issue. Now, in philosophy, the technical term for this is actually psychological egoism. And there were thinkers prior to Rand who basically advocated this, actually going all the way back to the 1840s. There's a thinker called Stirner, Max Stirner, who believed in this, but others did as well. It's contrasted with ethical egoism. So this is the objectivist view. The objectivist view of ethical egoism, meaning that it has to be chosen, that our self-interest has to be discovered, that we have to learn what's in our self-interest. Then we have to learn how to enact through using the virtues and how to act in ways that advance our self-interest and advance our values and advance our lives. So it's not going to be automatic. And one way of looking at this also would be to say, well, what about self-destructive behavior? Suicide, alcoholism, again, in the realm of to the extent chosen. In fact, a long line of human history has a lot of war and self-destructive behavior. So just on the surface of it, the idea that self-interest would be automatic as seems to defy the facts of reality. But here's another way of looking at it. If it were true, actually, that everyone pursued their self-interest automatically, then it wouldn't even enter the realm of morality. The whole point of morality is that it's you have choice, and you could do ill or good. You can do evil or good. And the idea of automatic takes it out of that realm. So it's like a beating heart. It would be like saying my heart beats automatically. And it is true that human bodily functions and physiologies are automatic to a large extent. They automatically are geared to self-preservation. But as thinking beings and conceptual beings, that's not automatic. We have to choose. So it is interesting because to the extent someone says self-interest is automatic, there should be no denunciations of self-interest. It would be as weird as denouncing the... Yeah, for those of you interested in philosophy, the psychological egoism is usually described as descriptive egoism, just saying, well, that's what people do, where EE or ethical egoism is called normative egoism. So the first, whereas the first allegedly describes, the second prescribes. So that's one, automatic. Let's move to the next one. And again, if you have questions about this or want to more on this, say in the Q&A. The next one, myopic. This one's very common, I think. Myopic, short range of the moment. The myopic view is that people are concrete bound, that the rational self-interest, excuse me, that the self-interested person is so. That they're very short range. We get these stories about the fly-by-night operators, you know, heedless of longer-term consequences. They're arbitrary. They're all over the place. They're ignorant of the harm they inflict. They don't give a damn about their reputation. A reputation is an asset. They don't care about their self-esteem. I mean, what about the power of self-confidence and self-esteem? That seems to be out the window for this view. So it's a very common view, even the admonition that, you know, honesty is the best policy. That is seen as, well, no, the scheming egoist is not going to care about that. The myopic having to do with long range versus short range and understanding and thinking through the consequences of one's action. One of the caricatures and smears of self-interest is that the self-interested person is myopic. Now, by the way, before I go through all these, in the back of your mind, think to yourself, what would be the possible basis for making these mistakes? And the underlying theme you'll see running through it is they do not have rationality or reason guiding the actor. You know, so of course, it takes rationality and reason and forethought and prescience to some degree to live a longer range existence, right? But if you say, well, reason is no part of the human story or the human equipment, then myopic. Now, notice animals are myopic. I mean, yeah, they plan to some degree. The squirrel gathers nuts before the winter, but it's all automatic to them. And they truly are short range about it. They don't think long range like humans do. So the basic distinction between humans and animals is lost on this smear. So automatic, myopic, what's next? Atomistic. Atomistic is the idea that you want to be a hermit, that you want to live alone, that you don't care about social society or dealing with others. So the loner, the person all by themselves, isolated, solitary, even solipsistic, a very common smear, a very common caricature of self-interest, that the self-interested person is within themselves. Sometimes this is expressed as narcissism, but we'll set that aside for now. But that's the idea. Atomistic, non-social, later evolves into antisocial. But now what is it lacking here? The recognition that there's enormous potential benefits, self-interested benefits that people get by interacting with others, by being in it. Now, in a particular type of society, if it's a self-sacrificing, cannibalistic, parasitical society, no. But if it's a rational, civilized one, yes, there's enormous values to be gained by being in a social setting. And the atomistic view just characterizes self-interest as not caring about any of those things. Next, materialistic. Also very common. Now, but materialistic, I hear, mean not the materialism in philosophy, but concerned only with money, concerned only with the commercial realm and monetary realm. The workaholic, the greedy money chaser. What is it missing here? You know, that self-interest would be operative in non-commercial realms like family or friendship or romance or even the way you spend your leisure time and recreation. That there's a self-interest in gathering around ourselves people we love and interacting with them. And, you know, so anything having to do with the non-commercial realm, this premise or this smear is the idea that it's not just only in the commercial realm, but that people are obsessed with the commercial realm to the exclusion of these other important realms. Another way of looking at this is if you thought of three main realms: commercial, that's when you're in the marketplace, say, working, exchanging, but we're also beings that, you know, go home at night and have a household. But we're also beings in the political realm. We just had elections in America, so we act in the arena of politics. And this particular caricature that self-interest is only materialistic leads to things like saying, well, in the political realm, certainly politicians are not self-interested. They're public servants. They're selfless servants of the electorate. And they since they're not in it for money, they can't be in any way criticized for being selfish. Now, same thing in the household. It's argued that, well, why don't you go back to the home? You put up with all sorts of crazy family behavior, irrational family behavior. You bail out certain siblings or others who are reckless. And again, it's the idea that self-interest only is in the commercial realm, not in these others. A clear error. Hedonistic. Hedonistic is the idea that the self-interested person only cares about pursuing pleasure and that they're somewhat arbitrary about it. And by the way, notice how this sounds. Well, it also builds on the idea of myopic. You know, I'm going to get drunk tonight and who cares about flunking the exam tomorrow? So the hedonistic view is not only that you only pursue pleasure, even to your detriment, but that you're myopic about it because you don't look forward to see, well, if I get drunk, I'm going to have a hangover. Even going the other way, I'm not going to incur near-term pain, say like a root canal, even though there's a long-term benefit, healthy teeth. But hedonism, licentiousness, all those kind of things, very commonly attributed to self-interest, as if it's in the self-interest of a person to engage in drunkenness or reckless behavior, promiscuity, all the kind of things that Mandeville years ago wrote about private vices, but somehow being transformed into public virtues under competition. So egoist as hedonist, you're probably familiar with that one, again, a falsehood. Now, the last two seem related, but the first, antagonistic, this is the sixth on my list. Antagonistic is just the idea that one's self-interest conflicts with, clashes with, is at odds with the self-interest of others. That there's inherent conflicts of interest among egoists. And sometimes this is portrayed as, well, self-interested people are competitive. They're, you know, they want to kill the other or bankrupt the other or hurt the other. They only see themselves as being benefited if they hurt the other. Sometimes in game theory, this is referred to as zero-sum game activity, sometimes negative-sum. My gain is your loss. It's very common in being used as a critique of, say, free trade or critiques of market activity, but a very common one. Antagonism, the feeling that the only way you can get kindness and benevolence and regard for others is to be non-egoistic, to not care about your own interests, and to care about only the interests of others. This one, I think, actually incorporates most of the many of the prior ones. So, you know, the idea that egoism is automatic. Well, that's, in other words, that's interpersonal conflict's unavoidable. It's inevitable. Or myopic, meaning, you know, potential ways of cooperating aren't visible to people. So they're going to be antagonists. Even atomistic, that, you know, resentment over having to act in a social setting in the first place. And certainly hedonistic. Sometimes hedonistic is interpreted and takes the form of Schadenfreude, you know, the taking pleasure in the suffering or misfortune of others. That's a very common view that is attributed to a self-interest when it is cursed not in one's self-interest to do that. Finally, sadistic. You'd be surprised in the literature, there's a lot of literature showing, or I should say claiming to show, that the self-interested person is literally sadistic. It obviously one of the harshest criticisms of egoism, but this comes up usually in issues of crime and punishment. Burglars, rapists, murderers, we know, are commonly described as selfish, as loners, as sadistic loners. Robert Hare, I show in my essay, a criminal psychologist, has written that a common trait of psychopaths, he says, is egocentricity, which is, quote, closely associated with a profound lack of empathy and an inability to construct a mental and emotional facsimile of another person, unquote. In business school, dealing with CEOs. And remember, egoism or self-interest, the commercial manifestation of that is the profit motive. And one of the reasons the profit motive is seen as suspect morally is because self-interest is. So profit motive is just the commercial manifestation of that. Or the pursuit of happiness, not so much a commercial, but a personal thing. The pursuit of happiness, a personal manifestation of self-interest. So corporate executives typically are, because they're in this profit-maximizing, shareholder-maximizing mode, are often caricatured this way. So I'm quoting here another notable medical, these are alleged medical studies of corporate executives, psychological studies. Quote, corporate executives relative to the general public exhibit a psychopathy was positively associated with in-house ratings of charisma and presentation style, such as, now get this, creativity, good strategic thinking, and communication skills, but negatively associated with ratings of responsibility and performance, including being a team player and a manager, are not. The idea that the self-interested person is a sociopath, so in other words, not just likely to be a loner or isolated, but with this premise of antagonism when they come in contact with others, knowing and being taught maybe that the antagonism is inevitable, are see it as eat or eat, be eaten. And so it's just presumed that that's how they act in a sociopathic way. I'll stop there, but I want to leave you with a kind of flavor. When this is all added up, and you just like turn to a, you would think you could just like turn to a book on, you know, in academia, a typical student would get a philosophy course in ethics. There's a book called Elements of Moral Philosophy by James Rachels. And, you know, it has all the different kind of moral codes in it. And one of them is covered as chapter 6, the last time I checked, called Ethical Egoism. But now here are some excerpts from that university textbook. He says, Rachel says, quote, ethical egoism is simply a wicked view, incompatible with the principle which expresses the social political ideal of human freedom, unquote. And elsewhere in the chapter, he says that, quote, anyone who accepts ethical egoism will be forced to abandon that principle. Unquote. The right thing for anyone to do on any other occasion is whatever would promote his own interest, no matter how detrimentally other people's interest would be affected. That's, you see why you'd say it has to be abandoned, because you'd spend every day fighting everybody and trying to hurt them by his premise. Quote, each of us would have to take the attitude that other people simply don't matter, except insofar as they are useful to us, unquote. And he finishes with, egoism is a, quote, pernicious doctrine, which goes against some of our most central moral beliefs, unquote. That's interesting because it's a chapter on ethical egoism. And if you look closely, it has many of the caricatures that I've gone through. It is just not a very scientific, fair, objective way of handling egoism. And, you know, this has bad effects on all the things that egoism undergirds, including, by the way, rights, is a great chapter by Tara Smith in her book on moral philosophy and political rights, that rights are egoistic. She has a whole chapter, The Egoism of Rights. When someone claims, I have a right to my life, my liberty, my property, the pursuit of my happiness, a very difficult set of rights to defend if the person is not an end in themselves, if instead they're seen as a means to the end of others, or frankly, if they're irrational and pursue their self-interest in these seven wrong ways. So I'll draw a line there and be glad to take questions and comments. And as Scott said, there's a link to an academic treatment of this, but I think you'll still find it readable. But it goes into much more greater detail and with other implications. So if those of you who want to read further, there's a 15 page paper I did on this in an academic.
Thank you.
Welcome.
We'll go ahead to Ron. I'll defer to him. And then I've got some questions, but we encourage others to ask questions as well. Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you, Scott. Richard, I'm an entrepreneur. One of my corporations made it to $1 billion acquisition in today's dollars, starting from zero in my hands, where the company had no employees but me.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I hang out with entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs. And one of the most common themes, this is all very in line with everything that you were just saying, one of the most common themes is that a venture either aspires to wealth, paying off the shareholders who get wealthy and so on, or it's designed for charitable purposes and to help the public good. This false alternative, this very nasty, pernicious false alternative is so ridiculous in my view, because if you look at the, I call it qualities of a great venture, the kind of things that someone would be paying attention to as an aspiring entrepreneur, or should be paying attention to, if their only interest were getting wealthy, the number two thing they should be paying attention to is there a giant potential market? A giant potential market. Are there millions of people, even conceivably billions of people, who, and this is the criteria number one, who have the fundamental human need? A great market and great wealth as a result of it is rooted in identifying some fundamental human need. Usually that people don't, you know, there's no market. People don't know it's a fillable need. There is no felt need. There are no competitors.
Go ahead. There's another criteria.
Yeah, there are a half dozen criteria. Well,
give them a chance to answer the question, maybe kind of summarize it.
I'm not trying to summarize the criteria. I'm just making the point that for two of the most important criteria require you doing massive good in the world in order to get wealthy. They are not mortal enemies. They're not in opposition. They're in harmony. Let me pause there.
Thanks, Ron. We have others?
Sure. Yeah. Starman, you want to go ahead and ask your question? No. Thank you for joining us. I don't know if you're able to unmute.
No, great. No feedback to what I said? Not a word?
Well, I'm not sure what, was there a question, Ron? You're talking about what motivates an entrepreneur. And I understand that, the desire to create wealth, and it's not at odds with generating public good. I'm not clear how to, tie that to my seven smears of self-interest.
No, you summarized my point nicely. I'll leave it at that.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you. Go ahead, Starman.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the delivery, Richard.
You're welcome.
I think I missed about 5 minutes of it, but, I caught most of it. I kind of have my own breakdown of it, but yeah, I guess I'll start with my questions. My first question is, in two parallel worlds with, I'm going to use Europe now, with two Europes, and in parallel world A, you had the history of Europe as, you've pretty much had it, like, history of warfare, conquest, reconquest, and, just constantly, just constant churning of conquest. And in parallel world B, you had the same Europe with the same groups, but instead of warfare, they decided to just focus maybe, I guess, on trade, minimum conquest, but just more focused on trade and interconnecting with each other. So in these two parallel worlds, which do you think Europe will be much more advanced, A or B?
Well, I guess I would say B if it's less warlike and more peaceful.
Okay.
That surprise you, or are you thinking differently? Or I think you set up a world which is a war of all against all versus one that's more civilized. I would say the second is better. I'm not sure that's as much to it.
I actually agree, but I've heard a lot of people argue for the first scenario.
Uh-huh.
That, in a world where there was, just high competition, that would be more advanced.
Uh-huh.
I agree that with more cooperation, that a world with more cooperation will actually be more advanced. Because if and I say this because if you look at the history of Europe, even looking say from the 1400s to the 1900s, 500 solid years of endemic warfare, or should I even start from the Sumerian kingdoms going back 5,000 years?
I would say that's a bit off topic, but I think what I want to would it might be beneficial for me to just say. Because you're talking about this, I alluded to it. Competition versus cooperation comes up a lot in these caricatures, with the general idea meaning that being that the egoist or the self-interested person is competitive, but specifically with the idea that they want to beat the other. So. On the other hand, we have this conception of capitalism where its competitive aspects lead to excellence, lead to people trying to do their best. And I think one of the more interesting things about egoism is that to the extent the rational egoist is not preoccupied with others, they're much more focused on how they can improve themselves or their business, to go back to Ron's point, And they're not in that regard other oriented, which should be more of the altruistic view. And they're certainly not of the view that if they do well, they're vanquishing a rival, rather they're eclipsing a rival. So if Coke, you know, outperforms Pepsi, it doesn't mean Pepsi is vanquished. It just means Coke has more sales than Pepsi. But that kind of competitive spirit is very healthy. And it's only in these caricatures that it's presented as nasty. And you could say that this actually feeds into some of the goofy things we see in, for example, in antitrust enforcement and antitrust laws, where the presumption is that a competitive winner necessarily did harm to a loser, so to speak, in the field. And so they attack the winners. If they didn't have these smears, if they didn't have these caricatures of self-interest, they wouldn't go there. They wouldn't assume that, as they tend to do. So I hope that helps. In personal affairs, it's generally believed, quite falsely, that cooperation isn't in anyone's self-interest. That the cooperative person or the cooperative group is the one that is caring more about others than themselves, and that's just not true. So I don't want to dig too deeply into altruism, which is the alternative counter, the rival to egoism, but I do cover that a bit in my essay.
Great. Thank you for that. Patrick, welcome to the stage. Are you able to unmute? Give you a chance there. Sometimes you have to, I don't see, you may have to leave the room and come back because I don't see the button. You may not have it at the bottom right. So when that happens, you have to leave and come back. Oh, there you go. Patrick, it looked like you were able to unmute. Go ahead.
Sorry, my first time, so I apologize for the delay. I have a question about self-interest versus the common understanding or often confusion about it, typically meaning self-dealing or a person who has a contractual or just some kind of a moral obligation to a larger group, whether it's a company or some kind of a group or just society in general. Can you explore just our language on the issue of self-interest and versus someone that is typically meaning self-dealing as opposed to just a general rational self-interest or long-run self-interest or enlightened self-interest?
That's really good, Patrick. That's good. Self-dealing definitely has a bad connotation. As a broad overview of this, I would say something like the Trader Principle, T-R-A-D-E-R, that Rand named the Trader Principle as the ideal of human interaction, and not just in business affairs and commerce, but and contracting, as you put it, but generally, including in romance and friendship and things like that, is the idea that there's mutual benefit, mutual advantage. The traders, trading value for value, aren't necessarily going to have the same benefit, but they both benefit. But they may benefit unequally, and there should be no envy regarding whether there's unequal benefit. But self-dealing in business usually is the idea that you're in a contract and your concern only is with your gain, and you feel somehow that you need to, what would be the word, to deny the benefits to the other side. And that's just not rational contracting. If you're conscious of the value you get from trading with a business partner or a longtime business supplier, that this, again, going back to myopia versus long range, the long range approach is more remunerative. And so you wouldn't want to engage in self-dealing. And other aspects of this, Patrick, that might come up, you hear a lot, is in, especially in group activity and contracting, is shirking or free riding. This is the idea that the selfish person in a group will be lazy and negligent and have others carry the load. And again, if you understand that you're in a group or you're in a contracting situation for mutual benefit, there's no rational self-interest in doing that. I would say primarily it hurts your self-esteem. So it isn't just the issue of, you know, you might be found out or something like that, but it's just bad for your self-esteem, is because you're not fooling yourself. You know that you're not contributing, you know, in the way that you promised to do. So, and this reminds me also of just issues of reputation. This comes up all the time in business, but also in personal affairs. Your reputation is very important. It's part of your character. And it's understood and crafted by a series of interactions with other people. And, you know, so it's part of character, but in business, you see things like branding or warranties, various ways that businesses show and signal that they're credible and then credible over a long period of time. But people do these with their personal reputations as well. There's a great essay, actually, in The Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal by Greenspan, called The Assault on Integrity. And it's a fascinating article because he actually argues for not having regulation, which sounds like a radical position. But the idea is, well, that doesn't mean businesses would do just anything they want to you, that there's an asset, a business, a demonstrable business asset associated with being credible and keeping your promises and developing a reputation and brand over time. Very valuable. So I hope that helps.
Great. Thank you for that. JP, welcome to the stage.
Thank you, Scott. Richard, I wanted to ask you, because this is something that often comes in debates on self-interest. When you ask your opponent to formulate an act that is 100% selfless and disinterest and completely 100% altruistic, you find often several, if not one, several examples in which any human action is self-serving to some extent. Is there such a thing as a truly selfless, altruistic act in human action? Thanks.
That's a good question, JP. Now, this comes up a lot, actually. So if you say, this is, I think, a version of the idea that it's automatic, but it's like a semi-version of it, because the idea is, well, no one could be truly altruistic all the time. And by this, I mean in the Auguste Comte sense, he's the one who coined the term altruism. It was not kindliness or benevolence toward others or concern for others, but engaging in self-sacrifice. And the answer is no, you could not do it 100% because you would be totally disinterested in your own well-being and you'd go out of existence. So this gets to the issue of still, if it's held up as a standard and yet you cannot practice it consistently, this leads to guilt. It leads to people saying, well, I should not be self-interested. I should be selfless. But I'm told that I shouldn't be. So I'm kind of smuggling in some self-interest or to cover this up, we have the word today, what, virtue signaling. What's virtue signaling? It's the idea that altruism is the virtue and you signal that you care about not your own interests, but those of others and those particularly of those least that you're least interested in, so they have to be far away in the concentric circles of your life. Why is that signaling? Why are they signaling that instead of actually doing it? Because it's self-destructive. But no, people still do engage in self-destructive behavior, taking a less violent view of it. Instead of saying destructive, how about negligent? That is much more common, right? Where you see someone not taking care of themselves. So they're not actually, you know, cutting their wrists, so to speak, but they're just not taking care of themselves. They're not and I don't mean physically. I mean, they're not planning their lives or caring about cultivating their careers or cultivating their friendships or cultivating their romances. It's not direct, you know, taking a knife to yourself, obviously, but it is a form of selflessness and it is a form of self-destructiveness. People can die in slow motion, so to speak. So I hope that helps. But yeah, if you're in a debate with someone and you're criticizing self-sacrifice and they use that, that's the way I would handle it. It's they'll try to say to you that everyone is technically selfish because you can't show me that they're technically always selfless. So I think it's just like a flip side version of the argument that it's automatic. By the way, I'm curious if anyone out there in the seven that I named, if you're in the audience and you're thinking, well, there's an eighth or ninth or tenth, I'm always interested in hearing alternatives that I may have missed.
Good. And we want to encourage people to come up to the stage. For the automatic argument, what about the idea that it may not be automatic, but that as we become more prosperous, that it becomes almost natural to become philanthropic, even though some then conflate that with altruism and wanting to force others to be as generous as they feel?
That's a good question. I don't know if it relates directly to the caricature that that self-interest is automatic. But I do believe there's a rational explanation for what you just named, Scott. And because I have seen this in business people, or actually just anyone who's been successful in life, and let's presume and let's just stipulate that their success has been, you know, largely earned and due to their rational planning and stuff like that, and, you know, not due to theft or exploiting other people. I find that those kind of people, as they become more successful and wealthy, you could say they become more philanthropic, they become more concerned about spending their wealth not on, you know, business ventures only, but on, call it, charitable causes, that is done, if it's done right, and I think it can be done right, it's done selfishly. There's a value you see out there. Maybe you give to the Atlas Society because you see the value of the Atlas Society. I think there's a lot of gratitude and appreciation that comes from people who have been successful and, you know, in a free country. And as they become to learn what it is exactly that contributed to that, out of sheer gratitude, gratefulness, I consider that a, you know, one of the minor virtues. I wouldn't put it up with this top seven, but people should be grateful. It's a kind of form of justice, a type of justice where you're judging that I'm glad this happened to me. I'm glad this thing, and I want to contribute to it and promote it. So those kind of things to me are all self-interested, but I'm not trying to answer the question in the sense of, see, I can show you that even philanthropy is self-interested. A lot of philanthropy is not. Anyone who gives money away, you know, in defiance of their career, you know, feeling like, well, I'm going to fund something, you know, the complete opposite of what made me successful would obviously be engaged in self-destructive behavior. I think a lot of business people who give to universities, for example, their alma mater, and to the extent they know the alma mater, say, is anti-capitalist, and yet they succeeded in a capitalist setting, you know, I think that is in many ways a self-destructive thing, that they're promoting ideas and systems that are at odds with how they succeeded. But philanthropy, interestingly, philo means love, and it means love of humans. And I think a selfish, self-interested ethic that the objectivism is deserves a view of philanthropy. It hasn't been written about much, although Ayn Rand's last public talk to businessmen, Sanction of the Victims, does have a section on the self-destructive behavior of them funding their own enemies. So she certainly was not against the, and we shouldn't be against the idea of giving our wealth away to things that are valuable to us and avoiding sending it to destructive foes.
Her wonderful essay, The Ethics of Emergencies, obviously has been read by her detractors who love invoking that.
Yeah. So that's on a list of things that people could write about, the rational basis for philanthropy from an objectivist perspective, guideposts for the wealthy giving their money and their time and attentions to good causes, good in the sense of pro-reason, pro-individualism, pro-civilization, pro-capitalism, pro-America.
You know, in...
By the way, can I just mention quickly, it's a very interesting phenomenon and totally due to self-interest. I'm sorry, Scott, I just wanted to insert, a lot of philanthropy of rich people comes from tragedies in their own life that seem random. Now, here's an example. Suppose a wealthy executive wife dies of a rare blood disease. It's very common for that person, the wealthy man, to spend money and leave money for that cause, to either open up a hospital wing or a research center, because it was so personal to them that they lost a loved one to this disease. Now, I would say that's very selfish in the sense of it really means something to them. They're not just sending it to any disease. Now, since diseases and tragedies and things like that happen, you could say randomly, so that no rich person, you know, is immune from losing things like this. It is an interesting phenomenon that over time, rare cases and rare diseases and things like that do get funding, not from government, but from rich people who experience the same kind of personal tribulations and setbacks that we all do. Sorry about that. Sorry, Scott.
That's all right. I was just going to say, I don't know if you saw the Men Who Built America on History Channel, but they actually presented Carnegie and Rockefeller as being in competition. And even when it got to their philanthropy, they were trying to kind of outgive each other. So, you know, see that kind of latter stage competition and self-interest work in a way that, you know, created a lot of libraries and schools.
Yes, well put. And concert halls like Carnegie Hall and things like that. Yeah, but they gave their money to, well, Carnegie Mellon is a university, but the university was much more pro-capitalist when the money was given than it is now. But yeah, when you think of it, universities, libraries, the arts, symphony halls, things like that. I'm sure you could see those guys looking at that and saying, this is what contributes to civilization, you know, or I wish when I was a young kid, I had access to a library like this or a schooling like this or a concert hall like this. So that was to me very rational giving, but there was a phenomenon in the late 1890s called the social gospel, where there was a mix of religious motivation and business thinking that, I have to quote, we hear this today, give something back to the community. And now to the extent that phrase means I took something from the community, it's like absolution. And that would not be the proper motive. But if it's more this motive I mentioned before of the benevolence of just feeling so good about having had a successful life, and why not spend the money on other values that might make it possible for others to rise up from rags to riches stories and scholarships, all sorts of things like that. A very rational basis for giving. I wonder if I'll also stress for those, the issue of egoism and and self-interest, I wanted to stress, because I don't think I did enough, that the main question in egoism versus altruism is the beneficiary. It's the idea of self-interest and ego is that the individual should be the primary beneficiary of their own moral actions. And notice I said primary, not exclusive. So egoism does not require that nobody else benefits from your self-interest, but that your goal and your motive should be that you are the main beneficiary, the primary beneficiary, and you don't want to sacrifice that to others. But sometimes a caricature has it as you're the sole beneficiary of your moral actions. And that's not a requirement of egoism. But the other thing to stress here is the virtues themselves are the seven virtues, you know, rationality, independence, honesty, integrity, on through. Those are ways of carrying out this primary focus. So the two are slightly, they're not overlapped. They're not synonymous in the objectivist literature. So be aware of that too. When you study the philosophy, the first argument for, and you do have to validate egoism. It isn't just, it can't just be assumed, but it is prior to the issue of now what particular practical virtues should I be using to achieve my self-interest, to achieve these values in a primary way. I just wanted to make that distinction. Altruism, of course, sets it off as you're only moral if your goal is to have others not just be the primary beneficiary of your actions, but that you do so in a way that actually you feel pain, you feel suffering. You're not just being charitable and giving away some of your surplus to things you love. The altruist demands that the person give till it hurts. It has to hurt for it to be truly moral in the altruist sense. And more than that, you know, if you just give your money to your kids in an estate, that's considered selfish. It still has some selfish aspect to it, right? So if you think of concentric circles around, you know, from family to friends to mere acquaintances to strangers to actual enemies, the altruist code demands that you give your money to enemies or that you give your efforts to enemies. Whereas within that smaller concentric circle, the egoistic approach is certainly, yes, if family and friend members are friends and others are of value to you, it's perfectly selfish to give and help.
Something to think about and traditional views of altruism. But right now I want to welcome Atlas Society Senior Scholar Stephen Hicks to the stage. We're glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Scott. I enjoyed your presentation, Richard. Nicely articulated list of seven. What do you think of this as a possible eighth candidate? The idea being that if we take self-interest, then we're not going to get any sort of universal set of moral principles because people are too different, and self-interest amounts to a kind of subjectivity. Doing what you think is good for you, but people are going to be all over the map. And so people who are then serious about ethics in the sense of there being universal moral principles, they'll say, well, there have to be these universal moral principles, so we can't base them on any sort of subjective grounding. And so self-interest is just not going to be the right way to get there. And it's not that we're really wanting people to be sacrificing and altruistic and so on, more that we're going to say ethics is first going to be about these impersonal universal principles. And then within that, we'll try to make some room for self-interest.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I really like that, actually. And I've heard that. And I'm looking at my list, and I'm not sure I could shoehorn that into any of my seven. So, yes, and I think the idea of a universal set of moral principles, if we tell me if you disagree with this, if we go to the objectivist approach and says, well, listen, life, human life, is the standard of value, and rationality and reason, you know, our unique faculty, reason, unique to humans, that is going to give us the kind of universality we need. But of course, each person's life will be the purpose. Their happiness is the purpose. So life is the standard, but happiness as the person and as the purpose in each person's happiness will see a different path or a different route. But yeah, I have seen that. And you're saying that that can be classified as a caricature of self-interest?
As you're nicely doing in your presentation, before we can say what self-interest is, we have to say what we think the self is, and that people say, well, the self is materialistic, or the self is this, that, and the other thing. Yeah. So in this case, the caricature would be to say self-interest means some sort of deep subjectivism, and from deep subjectivism, you can't get that. So the proper alternative would be, you know, as you started to say, well, the proper understanding of what the self is that there's a universal human nature, and therefore universal values can be built from that. So it strikes me as at least a candidate for an eighth caricature.
Yes, I agree. And I'm also thinking, Stephen, of the way Rand and other objectivists have set up the objective approach to this versus what? Historically, there's been an appeal to the mystic, the social, and the subjective. So, you know, God says it's right, or society says it's right, or I say it's right because I just feel that it is. You're also reminding me of Kant's hope and requirement, right? That there be a universal appeal, that the, and I think I've often seen that when I talk to religious people that, and they hear about the objectivist ethics, they'll say, oh, I like the fact that it's not subjectivist. I like the fact that it's absolutist. and then they'll say, oh, yeah, but it's, right. It's not absolutist because God is dictating. It's absolutist because human nature dictates, so to speak, as you put it. So maybe that's another way of looking at it. But that's very good. Thank you for that. Very good.
Great. You know, I guess with hedonistic, I know for me growing up, you know, I would sometimes test the consequences, like if I didn't turn in a paper and, you know, I was like, oh, I still graduated the class. And so that's some of what happens and maybe even distorts what's in our long-term self-interest sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and also another interpretation, Scott, of hedonism, and you could go through all this list and say, well, the real error here is excising reason and excising rationality. So how does hedonism do that? Because of its emphasis on feelings as primary. I'm feeling the pleasure and the enjoyment. That's all I need. And that's all that's necessary. And so reason is out, reason or rationality is out for that reason. Same thing on... automatic number one, I mean, just excises reason in the sense of, well, you don't have to choose, it's automatic, like the beating of your heart. So that one just excises the faculty from the start. But all of them basically make, I think, my theory is they come to this error because there's no conception of rationality to go with any of these formulations, you know, whether it's the myopic thing, same thing, right? Ayn Rand says, the anti-conceptual mentality, the concrete-bound mentality, the range of the moment—all those, all that language she uses, where she's basically saying it's not human to be short-range, to be myopic. It's literally not human, and yet this caricature exists. That's what the egoist is.
Yeah, that's good. Real quick, with the time we have, antagonistic. I mean, I think it's Marxism or even altruism more broadly, you know, with the fixed pie fallacy, that's what pits groups against each other.
Yeah, very much so. So interestingly, the Marxist philosophy denigrates reason, you know, it has poly logic, there's bourgeois logic, and there's labor logic and stuff like that. And so there can't even be a, quote, meeting of the minds. Because in that philosophy, the minds are different depending on class, depending on relation to the means of production. So yes, not too far-fetched that you would get a theory of everyone clashing with everybody else. And in the beginning, of course, it was just capital versus labor. But as that was exposed for the ridiculousness it was, we now have cultural Marxism. So the antagonism is, you know, men versus women and blacks versus white and old versus young and all those ways. So it's just a different form of antagonism. But yeah, the idea that antagonism is rife, you know, unless we become selfless clones in a collectivist ideal, the alternative for them is constant clash, constant antagonism.
Right. Well, this has been a great subject. It's a great segue in our last moments. I want to make an appeal to rational self-interest. The Atlas Society is trying to raise enough revenue to cover next year's expanded events to promote Rand's ideas to young people in creative ways. It's going to be a nail biter right down to the final days of 2022. But for donations made this year, a major donor agreed to match all brand new donors, full match. So $5 means $10 to our student initiatives. All lapsed donors, if you haven't donated since 2019 or longer, then your gift will also be fully matched. So $5 equals $10 for programs. Even all current donors, anything you give over your 2021 giving will also be matched. So, as you evaluate your year-end philanthropic goals, I hope you'll take into account the full scope and impact and decide to invest in the Atlas Society in your end-of-year giving plans. You know, but in the same spirit of altruism and not encouraging that, you know, invest, but not until it hurts.
Yeah, right.
So great. Well, thank you everyone for participating. And Richard, you've got Tuesday, you've got coming up about the election. So
right.
We've got a shortened week with Thanksgiving, but we'll look forward to that.
Great. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, everyone, for tonight.
Thanks.
Enjoyed it. Take care. Thank you.